Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Young, it's Here and Now. Defense Department officials are being summoned to Capitol Hill today to answer questions about a secret U.S. military program to plant positive news stories in the Iraqi media. Senate Armed Services Committee Chair John Warner says he cannot confirm or deny whether the military is paying to plant stories, but a U.S. spokesman in Baghdad seemed to defend the practice yesterday, quoting an al-Qaeda leader who once said, "Remember, half the battlefield is the battlefield of the media." Well, joining us on the line from Washington is Mark Mazzetti, correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, which broke this story this week. And Mark, remind us, who writes these planted news stories?
The stories are being written by information operations soldiers in Baghdad at Camp Victory, which is about 8 miles from the Green Zone. And they are part of what is called an information operations task force. And basically what they do is they churn out these what they call storyboards, which are depictions of events, counterinsurgency raids or thwarted attempts by terrorists to blow up Iraqi installations, that type of thing. And then they turn them over to this this private contractor called the Lincoln Group.
And the Lincoln Group, we understand, has been awarded a $6 million contract. It's a public relations group in Washington, D.C. Has the Pentagon confirmed or denied that this is happening?
Actually, the Pentagon has not. As you say, there were some military officials in Baghdad yesterday who sort of seemed to confirm it publicly and, in fact, defend it. But the White House yesterday said they were trying to get information from the Pentagon. The Pentagon said they were trying to get information from the military in Baghdad. And the Senate is trying to get information from everybody.
Well, in fact, yesterday a military spokesman in Iraq did say the purpose of this program is to ensure factual information is provided to the Iraqi public, which leads me to ask, are these positive articles fact-based?
They are. And in our first story on Wednesday, we said that this was not a disinformation campaign or an effort to plant false news. They are fact-based. They are, of course, one-sided. They present any raid in the best possible light, and they would not print any information that was detrimental to the U.S. or the Iraqi governments.
Well, Knight Ritter is reporting that the payments are made through the Baghdad Press Club, an organization founded by U.S. Army officers, and they put a fascinating wrinkle on it. They said it was actually well-intended. In the beginning, it was an attempt to help Iraqi journalists risking their lives, you know, to come to press conferences by paying them a little, but it got out of hand. And also there was another problem, sort of a blurring of the line, a fuzzing up, as someone put it, between public affairs officers in the U.S. military who do provide facts and information officers whose job is to try to influence people.
That's right. Actually, that happened about a year ago. The General Casey, the senior general in Iraq, decided to set up a strategic communications office, which, as you say, put under one roof information operations and public affairs. And the idea was to get a one coordinated message from the U.S. military in Iraq. But the concern is that you have this blurring of the lines where you have public affairs, which is supposed to be truthful and accurate information for a U.S. audience, and information operations, which is supposed to be targeting an enemy audience.
Well, Mark Mazzetti, Mary Madeline, former aide to Vice President Dick Cheney and a Republican spokesperson, has said on the Today Show, there's nothing wrong with this. The other side does this, so we need to do it as well. But we understand that many military officers in Iraq are saying off the record this is the worst thing that could happen there because one is quoted as saying, we're teaching them the wrong thing.
That's right. There's two points to be made here. The first is that their concern is that on one hand we have democracy being the primary mission of the U.S. in Iraq. And so to be doing something that might subvert the burgeoning free press, that would be seen as hypocritical. The second point is that there's a lot of military officers who came into the service after Vietnam when the military's reputation and credibility was at its low point. And they've seen in subsequent decades that the credibility has really built up, and now the military is one of the most respected institutions in America. And they feel that if things like this go on, they lead them back down the path where the credibility is lost, and that's their greatest concern.
And by the way, Mark, another anonymous military officer is quoted as saying he's worried about blowback. Have any of these fake news stories been picked up and distributed by international news media?
Not to our knowledge, but there is certainly that concern that when you used to have, you know, information operations targeting only foreign audiences, that was really before 24-hour news, blogging, the internet, where everybody reads everything. And so there really is that great concern that, you know, Western or in fact U.S.-based media picking up these stories, and that, you know, is where the legal gray area comes in.
Mark Mazzetti, correspondent for the Los Angeles Times in Washington. Mark, thanks for speaking with us.
Sure, thanks for having me.
Well, as we go into the weekend, we have a compelling story for you now about the great outdoors. By the time he was 22, David Roberts had watched two of his climbing partners die in fatal plunges. He was also on the scene when two other mountaineers fell, roped together, to their deaths. In 1980, he published a piece in Outside Magazine in which he explained why, despite all the death he'd seen, he kept climbing. The tentative title was Worth the Risk. Well, now David Roberts has written a book which he could have entitled Worth the Risk for Whom. It's actually called On the Ridge Between Life and Death, A Climbing Life Reexamined. And David Roberts joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
Have I got that right? You know, worth the risk
exactly
for whom?
Exactly right. In fact, that's very perceptive. I appreciate your rephrasing my title for me.
Well,
it seemed
fitting because?
In moments of doubt, as that piece ended up being called, I essentially analyze the question, is it worth the risk, strictly in terms of myself? Do the thrills outweigh the terrors and the losses? But it took me decades to realize that that was too simplistic and even narcissistic a way to go at it. That what I really needed to question was, what is the impact on those left behind, siblings, parents, when someone dies in the mountains? Mm-hmm. And so I actually went back and interviewed certain people who had been deeply hurt by these losses and came to a different, not a simple reversal of my previous conclusion, but I hope a more ambiguous and nuanced conclusion.
Yeah, it certainly is. I'm wondering if you can read us a section from the beginning of the book. When you talk about the death of your first climbing partner, Gabe, you were only 18 years old at the time. Can you set up the scene? Where are you
okay.
and Gabe?
Mm-hmm. As this passage begins, Gabe and I are two-thirds of the way up at the first Flatiron, which is a 700-foot cliff, but our rope has gotten jammed, creating a terrible dilemma, how to get to the place where it's stuck and unjam it.
Mm. And now are you tied together?
We were originally tied together, but to try to get the rope loose, I untied and flung the rope, hoping to snap it loose. Didn't work. But now we're standing out of sight of each other, trying to figure out what to do. The rope is stuck below him some 60 feet, and finally he says that he thinks he can climb down to it. Gabe's voice had an unfamiliar, choked urgency. I just got past a hard place, he said, but now it's easier. I guessed that he had climbed to within 25 feet of my shelf of safety. My brain whispered, "Bring up the rope, Gabe, and we'll be all right." I waited and stared. Far out above the plains, a hawk danced in circles on an updraft, mocking our gravity-bound plight. The sun blazed on my back and neck. A sound I had never heard before seized my ears, yet I knew at once what it was. It was the sound of cloth sliding against rock. "Dave!" Gabe screamed. Gabe's cry came up to me even as his body accelerated away. "No! Oh, no!" He began to bounce, the terrible arc of his trajectory longer after each impact. 400 feet below, he sailed upside down through the empty air, hit the cliff head first, and was flung into the treetops at the base of the Flatiron.
Reading that is sickening.
It's hard for me to read.
I imagine.
It's upsetting still.
And yet there were decades when you pushed some of those feelings aside. Can you explain that?
Yeah, one of my chapters is called Hard Man, and it's an old British term from the north of Wales and southern Scotland, a term of total approval for a really good climber who also is very callous to other people's feelings, very self-involved, and therefore capable of climbing when other people are too scared to climb or pushing on in the midst of horrible weather. And I think I became a hard man in my 20s and early 30s by doing that very thing, sealing off the gentler, more introspective side of myself so that I could climb at the highest level.
And seal off those incidents, you know, as right. well, so that you could climb at the highest level. And after the incident with Gabe, you go on to Harvard, you join the mountaineering club there. You have, you know, terrific climbing experiences, but also another death. A climbing partner, Ed, is there, and then he's not there.
Yeah, we had climbed the hardest climb of our lives, the west face of Mount Huntington in Alaska. And just hours before all four of us had reached the summit and were climbing down as the storm was just beginning to come in, and Ed and I decided to go down first. It's almost pitch dark, and we stopped to set up a rappel on this ledge. Ed is standing right next to me, and to this day I don't really know what happened. But as he leaned back on rappel, suddenly the whole thing failed and he plunged away from me. I saw a spark in the dark, which I think was caused by his crampon skittering on the cliff. And he didn't say a word and fell, I knew, 4,000 feet so far that he must have fetched up in a basin that we couldn't even climb down to look for his body.
David Roberts, when did it change? When did you start realizing that these things were still with you?
Well, you can't be a hard man forever. I mean, partly you just get, you use up your nine lives. I had too many close calls. And I'm rational enough to realize that I didn't escape them because I was a better climber. I was just lucky. I could have just as easily been me as Ed.
And we should say you're a good climber. I mean, you're acknowledged to be a good climber.
Yeah.
This is climbing.
This is what climbing's about. And also, I think I became more interested in other things. Like getting married made a big difference because Sharon, my wife, not only was not a hard woman and was scared to death of climbing, but she opened up the gentler sides, my capacity for love, which had really been sort of cauterized, I think. Mm. And also I found that I would worry about her worrying about me, which had never bothered me in my early 20s. Mm.
This is when you started realizing about, you know, the other people who were involved when somebody went climbing.
Yeah, 39 years after Gabe's death in the year 2000, I went back to try to find his sister and brother, who were the only surviving members of his family. And what I learned from those encounters was deeply disturbing, but also ultimately hugely valuable. Marion was still in a fury with me 39 years later. She had never understood the accident because the newspapers got it completely garbled, as mm-hmm. they usually do. But she blamed me for it. And the version that had lodged in her head had me as the culprit. Mm. And as she said, with a curse, she said, "You let Gabe do the dirty work." And it's true, I did. Gabe's father, who was the only effective parent at the time, had been killed in a car accident just 3 months before Gabe was killed. When Gabe got back from his father's funeral service, I said, "Gee, Gabe, I'm really sorry to hear what happened. And the first thing he said, he just blurted out, he said, "That's okay, when can we go climbing again?" Mm. And when we started climbing again, I had actually been the stronger climber. But after that accident of his father's death, Gabe became this stronger climber and nervier and gutsier. What I blame myself for is that at 18, I didn't realize that this wasn't suicidal on Gabe's part, but it was right out there on the edge. There was a kind of despair operating behind that apparent skill and nerve.
Adventure writer David Roberts, he's author of On the Ridge Between Life and Death, A Climbing Life Reexamined. When we come back, the pull of rock climbing and how years ago Dave had to pull one climbing student back, that student, author John Krakauer. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Here and now, and we've been speaking with adventure writer David Roberts, whose new book, On the Ridge Between Life and Death, A Climbing Life Reexamined, questions whether the joy of mountain climbing was worth the death of several of his friends. And Dave, you write, there's such a thin line between courage and self-destruction in climbing.
Right.
And that's one of the things you discovered about yourself, why you climbed. I mean, because they were there and you dreamed about what was happening at the top of mountains, but also to achieve perfection as your dad always wanted to get the home life was stultifying for you, schools were too restrictive for you. You just really wanted to get out there. So now that you have this new ambiguous, as you said, feeling about climbing, what do you do with that drive that you had to reach peaks? How do you resolve that?
Well, one of the sad things is I've never found anything that replaced climbing for me.
No. Wait, what do you say? Is it an addiction?
Probably an addiction. But it's also this quest for transcendence, for living a life that's so vivid and vital and dangerous that everything else doesn't matter while you're out there. And I haven't found that even doing wonderful expeditions all over the world of slightly less dangerous kinds.
But are you saying that you have given up the kind of climbing that might leave a widow in its wake? And I'm thinking of sharing
your
wife.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm not climbing now. I'm 62 years old. No 62-year-old climbs the way he did when he was 25. I still do climb at a modest level and as safely as I can. But climbing's always dangerous. I've had friends who have attempted the same strategy to climb at a mellow level in safe places in their later decades, and some of them have been killed. But I think I've found a way to do the little climbing I do, so it's just fun and not scaring me to death half the time.
Or scaring your wife to death.
Or scaring Sharon half to death.
It's funny, you come to this recognition that, you know, there are other people affected by what a climber chooses to do. And you say at one point you wish, you know, you'd been a better son to your parents, knowing how they were feeling when you went climbing.
Yeah, I on my very first expedition on Mount McKinley, the seven of us got reported missing and feared dead. And so for a long weekend, 3 days, Mom and Dad figured the chances were that I was dead. And it took me decades again to realize what that must have put them through. In fact, we sort of joked about it. We seven climbers would turn it into a joke later about the Boulder Daily Camera wrote a really corny article about Dad sitting there agonizing, and we would quote lines as if they were jokes from some old melodrama to each other.
And now you realize how he must have felt.
Yeah, and I have much more appreciation for the fact that they never tried to talk me out of climbing, that even after these deaths, they never lectured me or were overprotective. And I asked my mother just the other day why she never tried to get me to stop climbing, and she said, it wouldn't have worked. You'd have done it anyway.
I want to mention a sidebar to your story, which is fascinating. You were teaching climbing and literature at Hampshire College here in Massachusetts. One of your favorite students, climber John Krakauer, familiar for books like Into Thin Air now, but he was, you know, climbing with you back then. And it seemed like there was a pivotal climb that you had with him. You were climbing the east face of Little Tombstone. It's up in Canada. And you decided not to go to the top. Is that a pivotal moment with John?
Absolutely. John was 21. He'd been my student at Hampshire. I was 32. And we went on this expedition in the Yukon together. And he was then more ambitious than I was. He was like I'd been at 21 on Huntington. And we got all but the top 40 feet of a 1,000-foot cliff climbed. And all of a sudden, the angle lay back, and it got, I thought, easier. But suddenly, there was no place to get any pitons or protection, which is what keeps you from falling to your death. John took the lead and started up it, and just as he was making the critical move, a little nubbin he was standing on broke beneath his foot, and he fell. And we had nothing else in except my anchor. So he fell 45 feet right behind my back, and I managed to hang on and catch his fall.
But bloodying your hands with the rope.
Yeah, smashed up my hand. And then, as you say, instead of he came swarming back up the rope, and he said, man, I had it made. Let me give it another try. And I said, no, John, we've got to go down. We argued for about 5 minutes. And I think I'm convinced it was the right decision now, that if he'd fallen again, it could have. And I think he probably would have fallen again. The rock wasn't very good up there.
Where there might have been a time where there's no way you could leave those 40 feet and not do them.
Yeah, 10 years before I would have said, yeah, let's give it another try, as I had on Huntington when Matt and I nearly fell to our deaths.
That's but another incident.
John's never written about this incident in his own life. Yeah. I Into Thin Air was deeply traumatizing for John. Not only going to Everest in 96, but then writing a bestseller about it. And he went into a 2-year depression. One day I said, John, what is it? Why is this depression so deep? He got really angry and he said, figure it out, Dave. He always called me Dave. Figure it out, Dave. A bunch of guys died and I'm fixed for life.
Well, and you have a dollop of that. You've got a book and and a childhood friend who's, I mean, who's dead, and another friend who's dead. I mean,
yeah.
Well,
you know, this book tour I've been on, I got deeply depressed during the tour.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of being cathartic, it stirred up the old demons and ghosts.
Are you getting criticized by climbers who are saying, hey, you've sold out, you've...
Yeah, it's interesting. The strongest reactions I've had have been from other climbers who cannot stand to see their beloved pastime treated this way. I have a very good friend who feels that in his life, that climbing saved his life, that he might have ended up being a bum or a heroin addict without it. And for him, climbing is just an unalloyed good, even though he's had friends die in the mountains. But I wrote the book partly because I couldn't find anything in the literature of climbing memoirs and autobiographies that did this, what I was trying to do.
That said, maybe this isn't such a good
idea.
Yeah,
I mean, it's just one, there's an awful lot of chest thumping in those books and, you know, sort of mock sorrow where somebody dies and they'll say, oh, tough break, but it never felt very genuine to me.
David Roberts, his new book is called On the Ridge Between Life and Death, A Climbing Life Reexamined. Dave, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's been my pleasure.
And, okay, technical climbing comes off the list of things I'm going to take up. How about you? Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Funding for Here Young, It's Here and Now. The woman who underwent the world's first partial face transplant last Sunday in France regained consciousness today. Her doctors say her first word was merci, thank you. The patient is a 38-year-old French woman who was mauled by her dog. Her nose, lips, and chin were supplied by a brain-dead woman whose family gave their consent. A face transplant procedure is controversial, both because of the medical risks involved and because of concerns about the psychological toll the procedure may take. Well, to learn more about the controversy, we're joined on the line by Christine Piff. She's a survivor of facial cancer and the founder of a support group for facially disfigured people. It's called Let's Face It. She's in Kent, England. Welcome, Christine.
My pleasure to be here.
We're also joined by Arthur Kaplan, Chair of Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. Arthur, welcome to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
And I want to get reactions first. Christine, what was yours?
Well, when I saw it on our news yesterday that they'd actually done the facial transplant, I was so excited because the doctors have been talking about it for years. And it has been debated over here in England. And it is such a personal thing. And I can understand the dilemma that people who haven't experienced facial disfigurement are having. When you hear it, it's a sort of quite repulsive, the thought that you're putting someone else's face onto another person, mm-hmm. a dead person's face. And that's natural. But from the position that I'm in, where I have been involved with hundreds of patients who've had really radical damage done to their faces, and they do not live, they exist. They shut themselves away and they only go out at night down to get their drink with a hood over their head. And I believe that if this is feasible for them, if it's possible, then this is the way medicine will go.
Well, that's Christine Piff, who has had a disfigurement. But Arthur Kaplan, an ethicist, I know you had a very different reaction to hearing that this face transplant had taken place. You are against it. Why, in the face of what we just heard from Christine, which was awfully compelling?
Well, let me be clear. I'm not against doing face transplants in general. I was made very nervous when I heard about the French announcement. There's been a race or a competition going on among teams in the U.S., the U.K., and France to be first here. And the question is, are we ready to do it? I don't think the question is if we should do it. For the reasons we just heard, I think it is very imperative that people with this terrible disfigurement and these kinds of problems from birth or injury or burns have something to help them.
And what do you mean by ready? What are your concerns?
The animal data on face transplants is very weak. It has been done in rats and mice, not many, and it hasn't worked particularly well. The surgeons say, well, there's really not much more to learn there, but I think if you try to submit this data in support of a new drug or a new medical device in the States, the FDA would never let you start in people. They'd say go to pigs and dogs and make sure that you get functional and viable results.
And we don't have that yet. And why? What are the concerns? I know rejection of the transplant is one concern.
Well, rejection is a serious problem, and if that happens, it could leave a person worse off, as horrible and as damages they might be, you might be unable to eat or breathe at all.
And Christine Piff, we understand that any transplant requires a lifetime of taking medication and deep psychological issues when the patient awakes. You know, to help us understand why you, despite these risks, are still, you know, in favor of this, can you help us understand your disfigurement?
Because psychological trauma of facial disfigurement is something that really hasn't been investigated. It is so hard to put into words and to express what one feels when you look into a mirror and you see your face has been damaged. I have lost an eye, half my palate, my upper teeth. I wear two artificial parts, one a prosthesis which holds my eye, and one called an obturator, which is a palate that holds my teeth. And this enables me to speak and to eat, to function. And so that has restored the quality of my life for me. But what happens is the psychological inheritance of a damaged face is a nightmare, because you do not recognize self. And it's going through a process of rehabilitation and bereavement. And that's where the charity came in, because there was nobody for me, and I withdrew. I hid behind doors. I was frightened. I'd lost myself totally.
The charity that you founded is called Let's Face It, and there are now hundreds of people around the world who belong to this group. And Arthur, I guess, you know, the question to you, again, you have ethical concerns. Mm-hmm. If somebody is so desperate that they're living in their house with a hood over their head, mm-hmm. isn't it worth the risk?
To them, I think it would be, and I think that's why informed consent weakens and isn't to be trusted in these cases. I think people become so desperate, and this is one of those areas where anything might be grasped at. I'm not sure why the French team thought that this was the time to try it now. One other thing, Robin, to be concerned about. You have a situation where we used a face from a deceased person, but the French didn't tell us. They said there was permission from the family, but was there permission in writing from the person who died? I worry about the impact of the use of people to supply faces on the public attitudes about organ donation. Yesterday, people were coming up to me and saying, if I signed my driver's license and said I would be an organ donor, does that mean I would be a face donor? Hmm. I don't think that has to happen. I don't think it should happen. I think we should have explicit and very obvious consent from both the person and the family before this would happen. But you don't want to frighten people and scare people. To be blunt, you don't want to cost lives, because people say, I'm not going to donate a kidney, I'm not going to donate a liver when I die, because what if they take my face? The French didn't discuss this, and I think you have to have it out in the open, the conditions under which someone would serve as a donor, so that no one is panicked or frightened out of being an organ donor. I'm one. I want others to be one, but, you know, you can frighten people this way.
So concerns from bioethicist Arthur Kaplan. But Christine Piff, would you do this if you were given the opportunity? Would you have a face transplant?
Not at the moment, because I have now grown to accept my face. It's been 29 years for me since I had my cancer and my surgery. But had I known what I was going to face over the years, with a continual progression of having the rehabilitation and the reconstruction done, and there was an opportunity, then in retrospect, I think maybe it would have been an opportunity. But I don't say that lightly. There's somewhere inside me that sort of says, you know, it's like all these issues, there are so many of them because it's a face. That raises so many questions. And I agree entirely with what our speaker said, that how important it is that all these ethical issues are sorted out.
Christine Piff, founder of a support group for facially disfigured people. The group is called Let's Face It. She's speaking to us from Kent, England. We also spoke with Arthur Kaplan, chair of bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. He's in Philadelphia. I want to thank you both for starting a conversation that's certainly going to be ongoing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Christine.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Take care. And you're listening to Here and Now. Here in Boston, officials at the New England Aquarium are so concerned about a rumor that's going around about a boy and a penguin that they held a press conference yesterday to put a stop to it. The rumor is that a 12-year-old boy with autism visits the Boston Aquarium with his mother. She loses him in the crowd. When she finds him, he's agitated, so they go home. She gives the boy a bath to calm him down, and when she checks on him, the boy is splashing around in the bathtub with a penguin, apparently smuggled home from the aquarium in his backpack. What? Are our beloved little penguins marching off to someone's bathtub? With us on the line from the New England Aquarium is spokesman Tony Lacasse. Tony, do I smell urban myth?
Oh, yes. This is 100% certifiable urban legend. And this has actually been an urban legend that was popular in the United Kingdom in the early 90s. And it actually has hit a new iteration and a new popularity beginning this past summer. And we think it was tied to the popularity of March of the Penguins.
Of course, which has just been released on DVD. So get ready for more phone calls.
Absolutely.
We understand you get calls from all across the country.
Yes, just in this past week, I got a phone call from a newspaper columnist in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Got a couple phone calls and emails from people in California. In both those cases, though, they were people who had New England connections.
And you tell a story of an aquarium employee who was up in a diner in New Hampshire and actually heard a woman telling the story, and the woman said it was her son.
Yes, there's always, what we're running into is people are going to the beauty parlor, people are going to the grocery store, the hardware store, and casual acquaintances are sort of sidling up to aquarium employees and say, you know, I know that you don't want to acknowledge this publicly, but could you give me the inside scoop on what really happened?
Okay, so tell us what did happen. How did this story get started?
Well, as I mentioned, it's a longstanding urban legend, and we were unfamiliar with it. And then when we got many inquiries, there's actually a well-known website called Snopes.com.
We know it. Mm-hmm.
And it really documents and chronicles urban legends. And when I got the first inquiry, I was absolutely sure we didn't have a penguin taken. But I thought maybe there was some type of incident that I can explain this better. And then I actually called a couple other aquariums around the country, and they had dealt with similar rumors, but not anywhere to the same level that we did. We literally have gotten hundreds of phone calls, emails, and inquiries with staff.
Okay, so we have to say, you have said it is a rumor. It's not true. You actually presented penguins to the press yesterday so they could see you have your penguins. A couple other notes. I want to make sure my little friends with autism and Asperger's syndrome would want it be known they are not stealing penguins. But you also say it's almost impossible to do.
Yeah, it'd be very difficult for a child to do. An adult could make an effort to do it, but what'll happen is that essentially you've got to jump 6 feet into the water. There are no easy egresses out of that. The water's in it's 50 degrees. The person would be hypothermic in minutes. And then you'd have to be able to catch a penguin. And penguins are remarkable underwater flyers. They're very, very fast.
This is one of my favorite spots at the aquarium. You stand there, it's right in the entranceway, and you can look over and see all of these penguins when they fly around underwater. Well, it's like they're flying.
Yes. And they also have got very sharp beaks. Every one of our penguin guard biologists has some good scars on their hands for when they necessarily weren't, maybe they were hand-feeding a penguin and weren't looking. And these guys are still wild animals, and they're pretty capable of defending themselves.
So don't try it. Well,
yeah.
Okay, so it is a myth.
Absolutely.
But really, have you counted heads?
Yeah, we have counted heads. We count heads every day because we hand feed them, and so we actually document how much they're eating each day. It'll give us an indication if somebody's not feeling well, and we can follow up. We've got 61 different penguins of three different species, and they're all happy and running around and flying around actually under the water. So we're happy to have them all here. We actually did ship four penguins out to the Steinhardt Aquarium in San Francisco, but those are all planned activities. No unplanned exits from the aquarium for penguins.
Did any of them star in March of the Penguins or supporting roles or any?
No. Okay. March of the Penguins is, it's all emperor penguins, different species
sure.
than we have. Very big bird. They're Antarctic birds. And they're also, it was a completely, location shot nature documentary.
Okay, I just thought maybe.
Yeah.
Tony Lacasse, Media Relations Director for the New England Aquarium in Boston, putting to rest the rumor that a small child has been bathing with one of their penguins in the bathtub. It's not true. Tony, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now.
Thank you.
it's here and now. Tulane University President Scott Cowan is on a recruiting mission in New England. He's trying to convince students who are supposed to be attending his school this fall to return to the school's New Orleans campus for the spring semester. Hurricane Katrina devastated Tulane, scattering most of the school's 13,000 students to other colleges and universities across the country, and many came to schools in the Boston area, including Harvard and Boston University, where more than 300 Tulane students are now taking class. Tulane's President Cowan was on the BU campus last night delivering his pitch for those students to come home. Here now, Fred Tice has the story.
You would think that Scott Cowan's task of persuading students to return to a city that is a shell of its former self would be a daunting one.
Prior to the storm, 470,000 people lived in Orleans Parish. Today, 60,000 people live in Orleans Parish. Prior to the storm, there were 68,000 students in the public school system. This January, there will be 4,000 students. A quarter of those students will be the sons and daughters of Tulane employees.
And yet, Cowan told the audience of Tulane's students, parents, and alumni that the city is rebuilding.
And that rebuilding effort is happening with virtually no support from our federal government, no support from our state government. It is occurring because there are individuals and institutions that are, in fact, building that city back step by step.
At the heart of the reconstruction, Cowan told the 300 or so people in the audience, is Tulane.
New Orleans' future right now is totally dependent on the recovery of Tulane University. We are the largest employer in Orleans Parish. We're the largest economic engine in Orleans Parish. And we're the largest net importer of brain power from around the United States to the state of Louisiana. When we recover, New Orleans will recover.
In the days after Hurricane Katrina, Cowan had no idea where any of Tulane's 13,000 students were. He thought then that his university might never come back.
I can now tell you that for those 3 weeks after that first week, I did not know whether we would ever survive.
Fixing the buildings, Cowan said, was the easy part. The ground floor of every flooded building was completely gutted down to the studs. He said by January, the campus will look better than before the storm. Cowan decided to open a charter school so that Tulane's returning employees would have a school for their children. All children in the neighborhood, as well as the children of employees at Loyola University and the historically black Xavier University and Dillard College, will be able to attend. He persuaded Dillard College not to move to Atlanta and to use Tulane's medical school campus instead. Dillard and Xavier students will be able to use Tulane's recreational facilities and libraries and to take courses at Tulane for free. He says it's his way of getting Tulane to help redress the shocking abandonment of poor African Americans that was evident in the wake of Hurricane Katrina.
And you have to ask yourself in America, how can that happen? Universities should be the leading lights in dealing with race issues and poverty issues. You want to make a difference? You come back.
Cowan says Tulane will require community service of its students from now on, beginning with the reconstruction in all its dimensions of New Orleans. He says Tulane will organize the students and put them out in the community.
We're going to let you help.
Tulane found out that 1,000 of its employees and 1,000 of its students who lived off campus lost their homes. There's no housing to be had in New Orleans. Half the dwellings are unoccupied because there's no power or water. So Tulane leased a cruise ship to house students and displaced faculty and staff. The university also bought apartment buildings, leased apartments, and brought modular housing for 400 students. It's also reserved hotel rooms. The story of survival and reconstruction comes down to this pitch.
We got everything you need to come back.
Cowan is aware that some students, especially freshmen, have grown fond of the colleges and universities that took them in this fall. He believes that 90% of Tulane's students will return in January. 80% of the freshmen are expected back. And more students have applied for admission to Tulane next fall than had for this year before the hurricane. Chris Balfour, a junior, spent the fall at BU. His family lost their New Orleans home. He's among those who want to go back.
I'm from Louisiana. Family's there, home's there. And, you know, once you're out of school for 2 years, you just love it. And you make connections there, friends. It's your home. It's going to be exciting to see what you can do for the city. It'll be a new experience.
Phil Rothman, a freshman from Manhattan who spent the fall semester at BU, was worried about what happened to the belongings he left in the dorm.
Well, I want to go back because when I visited the school, I fell in love with it, and that's the only school I wanted to go to. I don't want to go anywhere else. I don't want to stay here. Yeah, I don't want to be in a city at all. I want to have a campus.
But not all students want to return. Julie Hall from Portsmouth, Rhode Island, spent her freshman fall at Harvard.
I've loved every moment of it. And I think that people are getting all of us, the five freshmen here at Harvard who want to stay, I think they're getting our story wrong by thinking that we've fallen in love with the prestige of the school. But I've really just fallen in love with the community that happens to be at Harvard. I love my roommates. I love my dorm, my classes, my teachers. I've just felt so accepted here. I feel like it's really my home institution. Just having to leave here is going to be really hard because I've bonded so much with everyone.
Hall recently went back to New Orleans, and that visit cemented her decision not to return.
I think it mainly has to do with my return to the city and just seeing the devastation there and all the rebuilding that the city's going to have to go through. And I think that Tulane itself will be fine, but the dynamics of the university are going to be different when we go back. And my parents are concerned about whether or not the professors will be focused with their work.
Harvard won't allow Hall or any of the other Tulane freshmen to stay. Most of the colleges and universities who accepted New Orleans students tuition-free this fall won't allow them to remain after this semester. The schools allowed Tulane and other New Orleans colleges and universities to keep the tuition, and they're committed not to poach the students from those devastated schools. But at Harvard, there is a growing movement among the student body to persuade the university to change its mind. For his part, Tulane University President Scott Cowan says students shouldn't come back unless they want to.
That's Here Now's Fred Tice. Tulane's spring semester begins January 17th. Well, we leave you with some good and bad news from New Orleans. Louisiana's top election official says the mayoral and city council elections in New Orleans should be postponed for at least 8 months. But some of the city is coming to life.
One, two, three.
That's yesterday's ribbon-cutting ceremony to mark the reopening of Arnaud's, one of the city's most famous French Quarter restaurants. Closed since Katrina hit, Arnaud's is once again serving its classic Creole menu, including oysters Arnaud's and shrimp remoulade. Archie Kasbarian is Arnaud's owner.
We have been part of this community for the past 87 years. We have no intention of going anyplace. And we're hoping the signal we send is we love the city and we do our little part to rebuild the city. And we're optimistic about the future.
What are you doing tonight? Arnaud's restaurant in the French Quarter in New Orleans is open for dinner. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlock, Tara Murphy, and Rachel Gottbaum. Doug Sugarts is our engineer. He's assisted by Vince Fairchild. Our web producer is Ken George. Our interns are Lara Farrar, Angela Kim, and Jessica Gerard. The senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend, and please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.